Welcome to Series 3, Episode 3. My name is John Pope. I'm a volunteer speaker with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission and a story moderator on the Forevermore series, which details the lives of people who died for their countries. I have an interest in the stories of the ordinary men and women who served in extraordinary times. A few weeks ago, I released a podcast roundup of Season 2 and referred to a story I'd planned to record about a young English nurse who danced with the Hollywood actor Clark Gable at a small pub in Chichester in West Sussex in 1943. The story turned out to be a bit of an urban myth, and I went no further with it, but it did provoke a number of emails from listeners who had their own stories about actors who'd served. There were several emails about Michael Caine, Christopher Lee, David Niven and Clark Gable, and some about Audrey Hepburn. One of the ideas behind this podcast is to encourage you, the listener, to suggest stories and share information about family members or friends that you know who served. So I thought I'd respond to those emails and prepare this episode about actors who served in World War II, some of whom were already established stars of stage and screen, and some who are yet to embark on their careers. As always, there are some photographs on the episode extras page of the Those Who Served website. We'll start with Christopher Lee, or Christopher Frank Carandini Lee, who was famous for many different roles, including Dracula, the Bond villain Scaramanga, and later Saruman in The Lord of the Rings. He'd led a varied and fascinating life even before his acting career began. Lee was 6'5", spoke 6 languages, and was step-cousin to Ian Fleming, the author of the original Bond novels. He also served in the Special Forces in World War II in North Africa, and helped in the interrogation of suspected Nazi war criminals. Lee was born in Belgravia, London, in May 1922, the son of Lieutenant Colonel Geoffrey Trollope Lee of the King's Royal Rifle Corps, who'd served with distinction in the Boer War and World War I, and the Countess Estelle Marie Carandini de Sarzano, the noble Italian family. After his parents divorced in 1928, Lee's mother moved him and his elder sister to Switzerland, and he was enrolled in an international school, which accounted for Lee's facility with languages. When war broke out, Lee initially volunteered to fight for the Finnish army against the Soviet Union. Fortunately for him, he and other foreign national volunteers were kept far from the action because they could shoot but couldn't ski, and Lee was sent home after 2 weeks. In 1940, still aged only 18, he joined firstly the Home Guard and then the RAF. After initial training in Uxbridge and Paignton, he was sent to South America and then to Africa, where a problem with his eyesight meant that he was excluded from any further flying. With nothing useful to do, as Lee called it, he joined RAF Intelligence and was posted to Suez and commissioned in 260 Squadron as the intelligence officer, specialising in decoding German ciphers. Lee was sent west through North Africa, where he joined the precursor of the SAS, the Long Range Desert Group. While travelling from Egypt across Tobruk and Benghazi, Lee was part of a team who moved behind enemy lines from base to base, sabotaging Luftwaffe planes and airfields along the way. Lee himself was unforthcoming about his military service, saying only, "I was attached to the SAS from time to time, but we were forbidden, former, present or future, to discuss any specific operations. Let's just say I was in Special Forces and leave it at that. People can read into that what they like." One story, real or apocryphal, is that Lee was often pushed by biographers to reveal more details about his role with the Special Forces. In one interview, he was alleged to have leant forward towards the journalist and whisper, "Can you keep a secret?" "Yes," the breathless interviewer replied. "Well, so can I," said Lee, sitting back in his chair. After serving in Italy, at Sicily and Monte Cassino, the final few months of his service saw Lee use his language skills to help identify and question alleged Nazi war criminals with the Central Registry of War Criminals and Security Suspects. Lee saw Nazi concentration camps at first hand, and of this period of the war, he only said, "We were given dossiers of what they'd done and told to find them, interrogate them as much as we could, and hand them over to the appropriate authority." Lee was demobbed from the RAF in 1946 with the rank of flight lieutenant and was decorated by the British, Czech, Yugoslav and Polish governments, although he was characteristically vague about what the medals were for. Lee's illustrious acting career only began a few years after the war, once he'd filled in time working in an office and as a switchboard operator for the pharmaceutical company Beecham's, both of which he disliked intensely. His Italian cousin introduced him to an actor's agent, and he was soon playing spear carriers and bit parts, but declared that his major break was his role as the monster in The Curse of Frankenstein with his friend Peter Cushing. Lee's career lasted over 65 years with numerous awards until his death in 2015, aged 93. Clark Gable was born in Ohio in 1901 and worked in the oil industry and also as a tie salesman and as a supporting actor in various repertory companies. He married and divorced young and was 30 when he secured his first film role, playing a villain in The Painted Desert. He was a prolific film actor and won contracts with Pathé, Warners and MGM, making 60 films in 12 years, including the Oscar-winning It Happened One Night in 1934 and Gone with the Wind in 1939. It was rumoured that Gable was one of Adolf Hitler's favourite actors. After Pearl Harbor in 1941, the United States declared war on Japan, and Gable was under some pressure as an established star to do his bit and join up. Whilst Gable didn't take much persuading, there was some tension between the studios, the actors' agents, and the Screen Actors Guild. All parties wanted to be seen to be doing the right thing by the country and the war effort, but also to protect their investment in the star and maintain their lucrative box office value against their equally costly contracts. Gable wasn't the only Hollywood star caught up in the middle of this triangle. John Wayne was influenced by his agent and studio bosses to defer his draft, which made him very unpopular with the public, and he was booed during press appearances. Others suggest he was more concerned that Marlene Dietrich might pass him over for another man if he went away on war service. He also feared that if the war dragged on for too long, he would be considered too old for leading parts. Either way, Gable settled the argument by following his fellow actor James Stewart and signing up for the Army Air Corps, the forerunner of the US Air Force. His studio tried to get him seconded to the film propaganda unit, which they felt would be safer, and indeed he did make some films for them, but his chief role as 2nd Lieutenant Gable was as an air gunner in a B-17 Flying Fortress as part of the 8th Army Air Group. But despite joining up, Gable was still contracted to complete a film, Somewhere I'll Find You, and his unit, aware of the propaganda value of Gable as a serving officer, readily agreed. But tragedy struck when Gable's third wife, the star Carol Lombard, was killed in a civilian plane crash whilst touring the country promoting war bonds. A grieving Clark Gable completed the movie under duress and threw his energy into his war service, requesting to be posted immediately to Europe. Although it took 6 months, Gable was sent to Army Air Force bases at RAF Polbrook and RAF Molesworth near Peterborough, in part to make a recruitment film about air gunners. Once filming was complete, Gable took part officially in 5 combat missions over France, Germany and Norway. He suffered frostbite, was narrowly missed by flak, having the heel torn from his flying boot, and lost crewmates, killed by enemy fighters. On one mission, he was unaware that a 20mm cannon shell had passed through his turret without exploding. He later told reporters, "I didn't know it had happened. I didn't know anything about it until we dropped 11,000 feet and I could get off the oxygen mask and look around. Only then did I see the hole in the turret." It's rumoured that he unofficially took part in other missions, chiefly as an air observer and gunner, but by the end of 1943, he was under pressure to return to the US. German radio broadcasts made it clear that they knew that Gable was serving in the 8th Army Air Group, and Hitler had offered a reward if Gable could be captured alive. Gable claimed that he would rather die in action, and requested a transfer to the Pacific, but this was refused. He returned to the US to complete a short recruitment film for B-17 crews, and following D-Day in June 1944, he resigned his commission as Major Clark Gable. The officer who accepted and processed his resignation was a young Captain Ronald Reagan. After the war, Gable's star waned somewhat. He never recovered from the death of Carol Lombard, and although he married twice more, none of his marriages lasted more than a few years. Shortly after completing The Misfits with Marilyn Monroe, the last film either of them would ever make, Gable died of a heart attack in 1960, aged 59. Audrey Hepburn, perhaps best known for her role as Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's, and Eliza Doolittle in the film adaptation My Fair Lady, was born Audrey Ruston Hepburn in Belgium in May 1929. Her father, Joseph Ruston, was a minor British diplomat, himself the son of diplomats, who'd been born in what is now part of the Czech Republic. He adopted the name Ruston Hepburn, believing himself to be a descendant of James Hepburn, who was the fourth Earl of Bothwell and third husband of Mary, Queen of Scots. Audrey's mother, the Baroness Ella van Heemstra, was from a noble Dutch family. The couple had met in Indonesia after her earlier divorce and were married in the imperial capital, Batavia, in 1926. Little Audrey, known as Adrientia, led a sheltered and wealthy upbringing. Her mother and father both supported the British Union of Fascists, and her mother once met Hitler, although their support for the Nazis did not last. After moving back to The Hague, Ruston abruptly abandoned the family, an event which Hepburn would later describe as one of the most traumatic of her life. Ruston moved back to England to support Oswald Mosley and the BUF. Since she spoke fluent English, Audrey Ruston Hepburn was sent to school in Kent. When war broke out in 1939, she had to be rapidly repatriated, and her mother, Ella, moved the family north to Arnhem, hoping that the Netherlands would remain neutral, as they had in World War I. Unfortunately, the Germans had other ideas, and the family spent almost 5 years under enemy occupation. Hepburn was registered with the authorities as Edda van Heemstra, as this sounded more Dutch and therefore less English. Her mother's Nazi sympathies were extinguished when her brother-in-law, Otto van Limburg-Stirum, was executed by the Germans in early 1942, in reprisal for an act of sabotage by the Dutch resistance. Uncle Otto had played no active role, but was made an example of as a prominent member of a noble family. The van Heemstras adopted an even lower profile by moving to the small village of Velp, just outside Arnhem, and whilst Audrey's half-brother Ian was deported as forced labour to Germany, her other half-brother Alex had to go into hiding. Young Audrey, still only 11 or 12, raised a little money by taking part in recitals and dance performances. This appeared quite innocent to German onlookers, but the money was being channelled to the resistance by Audrey's mentor, the local GP, Dr. Hendrik Visser Toft. Visser Toft often used young children to send messages and carry easily concealed supplies around the local area. The children were fast, had bicycles, and the Germans usually ignored them. As she spoke English, Audrey was also called upon to help with escaping RAF aircrew. After D-Day and the relentless advance through France and Belgium, the Allies launched Operation Market Garden in September 1944. Audrey's family home in Velp was just a few miles from the battle zone, and she and her mother hid a British paratrooper in their basement and helped him to escape as the Germans closed in. The Dutch civilian population believed that freedom was almost upon them, and indeed southwestern regions were liberated by Allied forces. But partly because of the failure of Market Garden and simultaneous strikes on the Dutch national railway system, Sees Inkhart, the German Reichskommissar in the Netherlands, levied a fuel and food transport embargo as part of the occupying forces' reprisals. This embargo created harsh conditions amongst the civilians, and although it was lifted, food was very scarce and made worse by the freezing winter conditions of 1944-45. People were reduced to relying on soup kitchens and eating nettles, tulip bulbs and sugar beet, and embarking on what became known as hunger marches. In her book, Amsterdam, A Brief Life of the City, Geert Mak wrote, "In search of food, thousands of city dwellers walked, pushing carts, prams and bicycles across the cold, bare countryside, searching for a few potatoes or a cauliflower. If they were lucky enough to find something, they would exchange it for jewellery, antiques, watches, linen, even sexual favours. Towards spring, as the desperation increased, these hunger tours would sometimes last for weeks, taking some walkers as far as Friesland in the north. Hundreds of Amsterdammers died from starvation and cold." Estimates suggest that over 20,000 people died during the Dutch famine or Hongerwinter. In April 1945, Allied forces succeeded in pushing the Germans back and liberating the Netherlands. Hepburn, then 16, later recalled that she rushed up to a Canadian soldier and asked him for a cigarette. She always equated the taste of cigarette smoke with freedom, even though it made her cough until she was sick. Hepburn suffered from anemia and edema and a respiratory condition which plagued her throughout her life. She attributed her naturally slim frame and ongoing digestive issues to the malnutrition she had suffered during that bleak winter of 1944. After the war, she moved to London and dropped the name Ruston to become Audrey Hepburn. She joined the Ballet Rombert to pursue her career as a dancer and actress. Her first major stage role in Gigi in 1957 led to her starring in Roman Holiday with Gregory Peck, and then a stream of award-winning films until her semi-retirement in the late 1960s. Hepburn later became a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador and did charity work until her death in 1993, aged 63, from appendiceal cancer. I'd like to thank Together We Served, a US blog about service veterans which includes links to many useful resources about the US military and some pages about actors who served in 20th century conflicts, and some which are more recent. I'd also like to thank the Imperial War Museum, History Hit, and various web sources too numerous to mention here, plus all those of you from all over the world who contacted me by email on info@thosewhoserve.co.uk. With your own stories and anecdotes, please do keep them coming. Until next time, thank you for listening to Those Who Served with me, John Pope. You can listen to the show via the website, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or a host of other platforms. If you do listen on Apple, please leave a review, as it makes the show easier for other Apple users to find. You can follow the show on social media via Twitter, @ThoseWhoServed, or on Instagram, those.whoserved. You can also show your support for this free podcast by clicking on buymeacoffee.com on the Those Who Served website. All funds are used to cover the costs of research, production and syndication. You can join in with the show by sharing what details you know of a family member or friend who served in a 20th century conflict. Contact me directly by email at info@thosewhoserve.co.uk. Thank you.